One of the things that is the most exciting is that we do get to create something from scratch and not just the words on a page, but again, it's the newsroom that we are hiring and the culture that we are creating the journalism that we feel like we want to see more of in the world, but also creating the kind of newsroom culture that we feel like will be conducive to that journalism.
So that quote you just heard is from Amanda Zamora, who is co-founder of news site The 19th. It's a non-profit, non-partisan newsroom reporting at the intersection of gender, politics and policy. That's a mouthful. So she talks about why she chose to launch the site with fellow Texas Tribune colleague Emily Ramshaw, some of the lessons she'll be taking from her time in legacy newsrooms, and what her priorities will be when the site fully launches in August.
So welcome to Media Voices. Peter has gone into therapeutic retreat this week, no doubt preparing himself for the debauchery of the Publisher Podcast Awards on Wednesday. So to ably fill his shoes this week, we're joined by Editorial Director of Digital Content Next, Michelle Manafi.
Thanks you guys for having me.
And I'm Chris Sutcliffe.
And I'm Esther Thorpe.
And before we get into the interview, we're going to start with our news roundup. And Michelle, we're really glad we've got you on this week because you might be able to provide context for what, on the face of it, seems like quite a mad news story. So Trump's re-election campaign is suing the NYT for libel over an opinion article.
So I see what this is. You've got a token American on here to have to somehow grapple with Trump's litigious, inexplicable behavior.
That's exactly right. It's effectively, we're just going to be barraging you with questions about this and accusations over the next couple of minutes. So the article, which was published last March, claimed that the 2016 campaign had a, quote, overarching deal with Russian President Vladimir Putin to trade election help for new pro-Russian foreign policy. But why go after the NYT for this now?
Well, I mean, President Trump has a long-standing adversarial relationship with the New York Times. I think he's made that quite clear on numerous occasions. And I mean, his personal opinions around the way that the press should handle a president differ widely from those of the press itself. Well, he's advocated for a change in our libel laws already, luckily to very little effect.
Is it for show? Is it as a bit of a kind of strong arm policy, or is it, you know, is there a genuine attempt here to almost silence the voice of the press?
Well, I will say, you know, one thing with American politics in particular and our legal process is that in many cases, laws are tested through the court system.
But I mean, he often threatens people with suing, doesn't he? He's always like, I'm going to sue this person, I'm going to sue that person. But this is one of those rare times he has actually put a lawsuit in.
I mean, the theatrics of Trump are well documented.
That's a good way of putting it.
So the threat is almost as fun as the trial itself, to be perfectly honest. Do you know who his lawyer is?
Yeah, so this one's fantastic. In fact, why don't you explain this? Because I saw the name and it really took me back.
So he is being represented by well-known media law attorney Charles Harder. And you guys probably remember, many of the listeners probably remember, that Harder he represented the wrestler Hulk Hogan. So right there, we have that piece of American theatrics. But he actually represented him successfully in a lawsuit against Gawker Media, the one that actually led to the site closing. Not to be disparaging of Gawker in any way, but the New York Times is not Gawker.
No.
And this piece is not the type of journalism that Gawker published and was clearly
saying
labeled
that
as opinion.
Yeah, saying that, this opinion labeling I found really interesting because I went on the article and it was very odd. It was very like, oh, there's no like new evidence here. It's not a news report or a news article in any way, but this is, if you look at all the things that have happened, this is my opinion that there is this this kind of deal that Trump's done. And this guy was like, if you read between the lines, this is clearly what's happened. And it's quite difficult to sue people for stuff that's labelled opinion because there's this huge thing about the law protecting the right to express personal judgment. But it was a very odd article.
Yeah, I was just, with the NYT, Michelle, is there this, because in the UK, people often, or the public rather, seems to often have trouble distinguishing between what is printed in the sort of the column pages versus what's happening in the news pages.
Well, it's particularly interesting that you say that, because one of the things we see with digital media as opposed to print media is that those labels have even less impact on the reader's perception. Mm. So I think when you look at the idea of opinion today being disseminated widely digitally, it becomes an even trickier situation in terms of the individual's perception.
You've tried to stop people sharing opinions on the internet. It's impossible.
They won't shut up, Chris. Everyone's got opinions.
Welcome to the Media Voices podcast.
Hello. So the combination of this being clearly labeled as an opinion piece, framed as an opinion piece, and about a public figure, it makes it very difficult for me to see that there's a legal win here for Trump on this. However, his being able to say it and get out during an election cycle and make these claims, really, it does almost as much for him as winning the case.
Okay. Well, then I think we should move on to a more optimistic story. So after a messy 2019, the markup is back for a fresh start. Esther, why don't you take us through what's happened here?
This is a long story. So people might remember the markup from the mass Twitter spat last year. So it was founded by ProPublica investigative journalists Julia Angwin and Jeff Larson and the former executive director of Wikipedia, Sue Gardner, with the backing of Craig Newmark of Craigslist fame. And about a year ago, Angwin got fired and everything just blew up. Like the editorial team were saying, you know, they're all on her side. Gardner ended up that there was all these conflicting stories going on about mismanagement. It was really, really ugly. I think it came down to basically Gardner just wanted to shift the role from like a tech watchdog to actually advocating against the tech companies, which Angwin argued was like not their original purpose and not what they were supposed to be doing. But when she was fired, the entire editorial staff resigned.
I mean, let's face it, you guys. I don't know, media Twitter. It was a telenovela of media Twitter. It was days of tweet threads and speculation and intrigue and drama. I mean, frankly, I'm shocked there hasn't been a serial podcast about it.
Just the quality of this team, you would have thought that if anything, this would have been very smooth, very kind of greased. And just I suppose it speaks to the difficulty of actually grappling with this topic, which is so huge and is so applicable to audiences.
And so polarizing. I mean, really, especially among media, the media world, we are at odds as much as we are in cahoots with technology. I mean, you know, most of our jobs now are completely enmeshed with the technology companies that they've set about to watch, to monitor. And I can see how those lines could become blurred. I mean, back to the Trump, you know, opinion piece. At what point do we shift from reportage to advocacy, right?
Yeah.
So you can see how the internal drama would simmer. To see it boil over in such a way was stunning, and so publicly.
So the interesting thing I found about this is that they've, because everybody is so paranoid about all this tracking and data collection stuff, they've gone completely the other way as a publisher. They've actually gone and there was a Nieman Lab article that was saying they took 5 weeks to find a newsletter provider that wouldn't track audiences. They've disabled all tracking on their sites and newsletters, and they, I quote, want to do things the analog way and build a connection with people directly. So, and Syed said that, you know, they wanted to try and find a way to engage the audience without subjecting readers to kind of this like surveillance ecosystem.
It's so smart, because how could you be doing this any other way unless you're actually practicing what you preach when you write about something like this?
Arguably, most people who report on this do not practice what they preach, Chris.
Yeah. Absolutely. The number of people who we know who kind of we're constantly sort of talking about massive violations of GDPR law, for instance.
For example, a little thing. Yeah. That said, though, what a bold statement. And in many ways, a very public statement of their position.
Assume if they're not collecting any data at all, you're going to struggle to get reader revenue, because you do need an element of... You can't do that unless you know at least something about your audience.
Well, you can definitely do it in terms of, you know, if you think about what, I don't know, we always talk about The Guardian and its sort of donation model.
Well, I mean, if they're really talking about going back to kind of an analog mentality in terms of customer relationship, then I would believe you're looking at a subscription or donation model, right?
Yep.
For me, what jumps out is the possibility of very self-sustaining newsletters, perhaps.
Yep.
Reports, you know, the kind of big ticket items maybe that could underwrite or fund projects. I mean, I look forward to seeing what happens with it. I mean, we know the quality of the work is going to be there.
Yeah, I think one of the things Neiman Lab did point out is that despite everything that happened last year, that was actually probably really good for the brand. I think Angwin itself actually said that it was an excellent team building exercise. So yeah,
I see what you're saying. I'm picking up what you're putting down. You're saying that they faked it. You're saying that this is a I know what. No, Esther, I can read between the lines.
Your tech paranoia is profound. I love it. And now the news in brief.
You know, you're the first person we've allowed to do that.
I feel lucky. So you guys, some interesting news from Disney this week.
Surprise news.
Big surprise news. Holy mouse ears. Disney's chief executive, Bob Iger, stepped down. He said it was the optimal time following the acquisition of Fox's entertainment assets and the launch of Disney Plus. In even more surprising news, he's going to be replaced by Disney Parks chairman Bob Chapek.
Well, I mean, to be fair, if you look at Disney's revenue, the parks are such a huge part of this. I think if they went, right, if he can be trusted with kind of the lifeblood of our company, then maybe he can be trusted with whatever we're doing digitally. I don't know.
The thing is, I mean, you have a point, right? So I think one of the things people forget about with Disney, because what is so public facing is the baby Yoda of it all, right? But the reality is...
Oh, you've just made a friend for life in Esther.
We finally get to mention baby Yoda on the podcast in a legitimate context.
I mean...
My day is made. I suppose it's just that thing that, you know, Disney Plus has just launched. It is still so, so new to the market and it's doing really well. But it's in no way clear yet. Like, the next, you know, 2 to 3 years are going to be critical for it in terms of, like, a make or break. So it's quite an odd time to hand over portion. I know one of the Wall Street analysts that said this, that it's, as those worlds kind of collide, this is a really odd time to hand that over.
Right.
Somebody who is not a tech guy.
Well, nor was Bob Iger. If you look at what happened when he was brought on, people thought he was kind of the safe.
People were pretty negative about it when they brought in Iger.
And yeah, he's overseen this fundamental shift towards kind of, well, as you said, towards the launch of Disney Plus and its real diversification in terms of content type as well.
You know,
and Baby Yoda made a big difference.
I mean, Baby Yoda makes all the difference.
It's the only reason I'm paying for it when it comes here in March.
So my big worry is that our conclusion at the end of this is that every media company needs to get its own Baby Yoda.
Yeah.
Moving on, following us discussing this topic 2 weeks ago, the UK's media regulator Ofcom has vowed not to interfere in the editorial independence of news websites. So we said this at the time, it was effectively a guarantee that it wouldn't try to moderate editorial content at all. But given the remit, I think this is at least partly due to the fact that it would have been impossible for them to have done this anyway. The task they've been given in itself is gargantuan, so this would have been impossible.
So are they going to stick their nose into Facebook, though?
Yes.
I mean, entire thing is about sticking their nose into Facebook. Let's face it. There may be some polite language, being English and all, around what they plan to do. But it's all about social platforms.
So daily sales of our favorite paper, The Sun, have fallen by 8% to 1.38 million last year. But it still remains the UK's most popular newspaper. The owners' news group newspapers have also reported a 68 million loss as they continue still to deal the fallout of the phone hacking scandal. How long has that been going on for now?
Oh my God. I mean, at this point, every year they basically said, you know what, we've grappled with most of it now and now we can get back on track. But of that £68 million loss, the vast, vast majority of it is attributed to phone hacking. It is unbelievable.
The phone hacking scandal, the scandal that keeps on taking. Well, you guys have probably heard about this one. The BBC has decided not to appeal against the equal pay case involving Newswatch presenter Samira Ahmed after she won an employment tribunal. Ugh, that sounds harsh, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It's given hope to other women seeking back pay from the broadcaster.
So fun one here from Joshua Benton, writing for Nieman Lab, explaining that in Norway and Sweden, a survey's found that some people won't pay for online news because the news from their free public broadcaster is good enough.
I thought Norway had the highest rates of people paying for news.
No, I'm sorry, but you guys have a different definition of fun than...
Sorry. That's fair enough. But just imagine the implications for places like the UK, where we also have this tradition of a very strong public broadcaster. That
I thought that's one of the reasons why the UK was so low for people actually paying for news.
You guys, have you noticed that the internet has a boatload of free news, though?
Yes, I have noticed that. It's impossible.
There's a lot. Arguably a metric shit ton.
Yeah, about that.
And people are still paying for news here. People aren't paying for local news. Local news is dropping like flies. But people are paying for the New York Times. People are paying for the Washington Post. While I understand that the quality is probably a factor when you look at Sweden and Norway or the UK, I mean, the BBC is the BBC. Mm. Free exists, right? For fee has got to add value.
That is way too big for us to grapple with in News in Brief.
All right. Well, yeah. You'll have to have me back.
We will.
Yeah. Apple, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Amazon have lost more than, it's just a casual, $238 billion in value this week as part of a broader market dive and economic concerns around the coronavirus outbreak.
Okay. Once we get past the idea that that's their couch change. Now I can get nervous about it. No, that's a big number. That's a terrifying number. And there are certainly economic concerns for all kinds of industries, tech being one of the hardest hit, I think.
Yeah. You see it with these. Obviously, tech is predominantly, it's kind of dependent on things like expos. And so we've seen this in conferences, the number of conferences that have been either cancelled or deferred this week.
If everybody gets sent home and we all have to sit at home for 2 weeks... We're going to be sitting on our iPhones. We're going to be sitting on... We're going to be reactivating our Facebook because we're bored. We're going to be ordering stuff from Amazon to be delivered by drone. We're going to be watching Netflix.
I saw a story today, Esther, that said that the streaming services are benefiting from the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, I unfortunately am very well set up to work from home, so I have no excuse. But loads of people are just sitting watching Netflix.
So Facebook has announced a $2 million investment to support independent science research on misinformation and polarization related to social communication technologies.
Wait, communication technologies?
Weird.
Yeah.
I've also heard that Facebook might have a little bit to do with misinformation and disinformation as well.
Are we not being a bit cynical here? I've never heard anything to suggest that Facebook is, you know, even involved in the dissemination of misinformation.
I mean, it's hilarious. So first of all, the number 2 million, see earlier pocket change remark.
They
have such a poor track record with this, right? They said, last election cycle, that they were going to release data to researchers. They said, hopefully by the end of the year, we'll release this data. Almost 2 years later, they released the data. And they said it was due to, oh, Lord, I'm going to have trouble even getting this out with a straight face. They said it was because they were having trouble providing the data while protecting consumers' privacy.
That's an unusual concern for them to have.
I mean...
Digital publishers are in for a very nice time this year, with 69% of them expecting to see overall revenue growth, according to a new report from Folio. So this is good. Good news.
Oh, yeah. This is fantastic. And this one I think we should end on because it is some of the best, the most evocative language that we've ever featured on this podcast. So TikTok, social video platform, it's taken a bit of a PR battering this week. Business Insider ran a story basically calling it out on being a vector for some very nasty online bullying around the kind of the term chav. More importantly, Reddit CEO accused it of being, quote, fundamentally parasitic, which is such a lovely turn of phrase for something so horrifying.
I mean, I wish I wrote it because it's so lovely. No, right?
That's also very much the pot calling the kettle black. Reddit's hardly a shining corner of the internet.
No, but Reddit's tidied itself up quite a bit. And it's more importantly, it's not the... you know, everything that Reddit does wrong is on full display. This is kind of the back end.
Yeah,
because very scary.
Because that fundamentally parasitic quote, I mean, that's a tiny piece of his quote, right? He's talking about the tracking, just how invasive TikTok is as an app on a phone, akin to many of its other social media brethren, though. Yeah. Not sure I would say that it is the worst, because, you know, the association with China because of ByteDance gives a lot of people this kind of overblown paranoia around it, when at least from what the Reddit quote said, I find it consistent with the behavior of, say, a Google.
So this week I spoke to Amanda Zamora about the 19th and its aim to empower women, especially those underserved by and underrepresented in American media. So I started by asking her to explain what the 19th is and what gap it fills in the media market.
We launched the 19th, I guess, like almost a month ago now. Our goal is to create a new nonpartisan news platform dedicated to covering the intersection of gender, politics, and policy. Our, you know, target audience is women, but also those who identify with and as women. And basically the gap that we see that we're attempting to fill is just a dedicated platform that is examining, you know, these issues, policy issues as it impacts women, and that seeks to elevate, you know, the voices of women at the margins, you know, sort of off the coasts, women of color, communities of color, just the voices that we're not hearing enough of in mainstream coverage. That's really the long and the short of it.
You launched this with Emily Ramshaw, and you both left the Texas Tribune to launch this. How did that happen? Like, did you kind of both see something at the same time that needed to happen?
This is really Emily's brainchild, and I think she would say that the seeds of this were really planted for her as she became a new mother, a first-time mother, around the time of the 2016 election. And I think that had a profound impact on the way that she reevaluated not only, you know, the journalism and the stories that she was reading, but also the way that they were being produced, frankly. How do we assign stories? What do we even conceive of as worthy of a story? How do we, you know, whose bylines are sort of, are we seeing on a day-to-day basis? Are those bylines that we can identify ourselves in and with? Who's making these decisions? And I think, you know, the seed for her was planted then. And about a year ago now, she came to me, you know, just from a conference, really, where she was kicking around, revisiting this idea with others. And just, I think it snowballed for her in realizing we're coming up upon another election cycle. And, you know, imagining that, you know, someone would have thought, you know, given all of the coverage around the Me Too movement, given the fact that we have more women running for president now than ever before, that someone would think of this idea, but no one else had. And so I think she is the catalyst really for the 19th, and, you know, taking that germ of an idea and, you know, raising it as a question, you know, to me, like, do you think that we could actually make this a reality? And about a year later, the answer is yes. And we are so thrilled to be, you know, in a position where the 19th, the beginnings of the 19th are here. You know, we have the website up and running. We have the mission out into the world. We're beginning to hire. And the next step for us is, you know, creating what we hope is, you know, one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse, newsrooms in the country, to really reimagine how we tackle politics and policy coverage.
And touching on that, I mean, women is a huge it's a 50% of the country demographic in theory. And I mean, you've already touched a bit that you want to make it diverse. I mean, is this aimed at women sort of at absolutely all ends of the spectrum? Like, what does that women-focused news lens look like?
Sure. I mean, first of all, it starts with not treating women as a monolithic, voting bloc, and acknowledging that, women are in and of themselves a diverse voting bloc, whether it comes to where you live, whether it comes to sort of your race, your socioeconomic status, your ideology. I can tell you, I am a Mexican American. I am the daughter of an immigrant. And I think oftentimes the way that I see, Latinos portrayed in the mainstream media, or, those, even just observing how things play out in Texas, it's always way more nuanced than I feel is represented in mainstream media. And so trying to, hire a newsroom whose, primary objective is to really put themselves in the shoes of the audience that we're serving, and who can draw on their own lived experiences and in community, as well as, reaching out to our audience and trying to understand more about what they are living through as it comes to, how policy impacts their lives day to day. I think it's just a fundamentally different way of approaching political journalism, which, we can see here in an election year. A lot of it is so much of the rise and fall of candidates and the horse race. And it's just a different tack.
We've got a rule about not mentioning Trump's name, but I can't when you're talking about something like this. You've got characters like Trump, and you've got the coverage of him that is so polarized. And I know you said you want the 19th to kind of try and be a bit more nonpartisan, but from the women's perspective, sometimes it feels like there almost isn't a balance you can provide on that kind of thing. So how are you going to approach, if Trump makes comments about women and things like that?
I mean, we're going to approach it the same way that we approach all of our coverage, which is to stick to the facts, and the facts of what we're seeing, in terms of what women are saying matters to them, what issues matter to them most, the barriers or obstacles that women who are running for elected office face. Equity is going to be sort of a through line in all of our coverage, whether that's access to the voting booth, access to, elected office, access to the, executive ranks in corporate America, or frankly, those who are, showing up at work day to day and not realizing, the wages that they necessarily deserve. So I think there's plenty of room for us to cover some of these thornier issues by simply opening up our notebooks, making ourselves accessible to our audience and inviting their tips, their stories, their perspectives, and covering, using, the same kind of data-driven, fact-based approach to journalism that we have, frankly, we've done. I was at the Texas Tribune for 4 years, Emily for the better part of a decade. I come from ProPublica and the Washington Post, and both of us have a long history of sort of really high quality, credible, fact-based journalism. And that's what we're planning on replicating here in the 19th newsroom.
Are there lessons you're going to be taking from your time at the Texas Tribune? Because I think you were chief audience officer, weren't you?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, most certainly. I think the revenue model is going to be one thing that we carry with us. We're going to be a nonprofit, but we feel like a diverse revenue model is the way to go. So we're going to be leaning on a mix of foundation and major philanthropy funds. We're going to be leaning on corporate revenue through some digital advertising and sponsorship. We're also going to have events as sort of a key ingredient, not only in the revenue mix, but also in something that differentiates the journalism. We think that events are an opportunity to engage in acts of live journalism, in bringing our audience together in conversation with newsmakers, elected officials, with each other, with us. So there's so much that we are going to be bringing with us in terms of what we learned at the Texas Tribune, and bringing it to a national platform, and seeing, how much further, what more there is to learn, and how we can scale it for sort of a national audience. We think we have all of the right ingredients, and we're really eager to get started.
And at the moment, you've got some articles running on the Washington Post, haven't you? Will that partnership continue past August?
I most certainly hope that we will continue to partner with, you know, the Washington Post and many other news organizations. I think the other ingredient I forgot to mention in terms of, you know, what we're bringing with us from the Texas Tribune is our distribution model, which is that unlike, you know, commercial media, we are not expecting to put our content behind a paywall ever. Our content will be free to read, but also free to republish. And one of the ways that we feel that we meet our mission in terms of providing a public service and making this journalism as accessible as possible to the women who we hope to reach is to make it as easy as possible for publishers around the country, whether they're daily newspapers, regional newspapers, community publishers, to pick up our content and republish it. Yes, I hope that we continue to publish through the Washington Post. We have a lot of good relationships, you know, with newsrooms around the country, and we think we're going to continue to kind of carry that spirit of collaboration forward in a way that hopefully helps us reach more of the women that we are hoping to reach.
And you've mentioned a little bit, but you've worked in a number of really prestigious legacy newsrooms in the past. I think you were saying Washington Post, ProPublica. But running a startup newsroom is going to be a completely different kettle of fish. So what are some of the things you're maybe looking forward to tackling, or, you know, challenges you're anticipating?
Oh, I think it's actually, I will confess that I have a tiny bit of experience in startup mode, that I had a brief stint at the Huffington Post, I think 2009, wow, right after the financial crash. There was a short-lived but very instructive experience for me, in any case, starting up the Huffington Post Investigative Fund, which was also meant to be an investigative nonprofit. And I think that was a nice sort of bit of trial by fire in terms of having a sober understanding of how much work it would be. I mean, you really, when you go into startup mode, I mean, it's all hands on deck. You're wearing so many hats. And so we're totally in that mode right now, in fire hose mode. It's so overwhelming. It's also so much fun. And I think one of the things that is the most exciting is that we do get to create something from scratch, and not just the words on a page, but again, it's the newsroom that we are hiring, and the culture that we are creating, you know, embracing, you know, the idea that women deserve to have a strong, you know, the opportunity to take the time to have a child or to take care of a family member. Our paid leave policy was created and designed with that in mind, and just all of those details that go into not just putting the stories out day to day, but really creating the environment that we feel like is going to be conducive to creating the journalism that we feel like we want to see more of in the world, but also creating the kind of newsroom culture that we feel like will be conducive to that journalism.
So you've really got to sort of walk the walk, not just talk the talk.
Totally.
What does that team look like at the moment? Kind of, who have you got on board?
Sure. Well, we have, let's see, there are six of us now. We have Andrea Valdez, who is our editor-in-chief. She came to us from the Texas Observer. And we have Erin Haynes, who is just an incredible force of a journalist who is covering the 2020 campaign trail for us. It's Erin's stories that you will find. If you sign up for our newsletter, we send a roundup of her stories every Friday, but they're also in the Washington Post. We have Johanna Derlega, who is leading up our corporate revenue operation and helping us gather the sponsors to our products that we are, you know, looking to sustain the business with the corporate revenue side of things. And of course, Emily Ramshaw, who's our CEO and my co-founder and partner in crime in all of this. We also have a lovely CFO. His name is Jeff Dean, and he is helping us with all of our running the numbers and making sure that we are planning you know, that what we have planned is sustainable, and that we're being as smart as we can about all the day-to-day decisions that we're making. And so it's a really solid team so far. And right now we're really focused on hiring up the journalists in the newsroom, hiring up all of the product roles, the design, audience engineering roles that we need to create the platform now that we have dreamed of creating.
And when the site goes live in August, which will come up quite quickly, what's kind of top of your to-do list? You know, what do you want to achieve in that, in those first couple of months?
Well, we certainly want to, you know, have the kind of journalism around the 2020 race that serves our audience and that we feel like helps you know, our readers evaluate what's happening in a new way. We're also going to have someone based in Congress helping to kind of look at the races, you know, the women candidates who are running there. We're going to have reporters sort of embedded in the women's electorate, whether with their ear to the ground, with Latina voters, with Black voters, with voters in different communities. We're going to have reporters focused on health, the economy, looking at policy that's burbling up in state houses that affects women. So, I mean, we have a fairly ambitious, you know, coverage plan. We certainly are going to continue to focus on how the presidential election is playing out. We also have a listening tour that kicks off in April, actually, and that will continue right up through the election, where we're asking women, you know, what issues matter most to you as we head into November. And we will expect to be reporting out on some of what we learned over the course of that 6 month period as we, you know, get geared up for November. So, yeah, I think we really are excited about just getting our journalism online and understanding actually that we're going to constantly be learning. Every day that we publish is an opportunity to learn more about our audience and hear from our audience. And I think that's going to be another key ingredient to doing what we do. Engagement is a big part of our strategy. We want to not only be you know, reporting the news, but engaging our audience in the news. And that means, you know, listening, creating opportunities for us to listen to them, whether it's at our events or in through online channels or the newsletter, and reporting back based on what we learn.
And a big question now, if we're looking sort of 5 years down the line, what will success look like to you for the 19th?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough question. I'm just trying to get through the end of year one. But I mean, I hope that we are a mainstream, you know, name that people, when they are thinking about what's happening on the political landscape, on the national landscape, when it comes to news, that we're a household name, that people know, you know, what the 19th is, and that we have really moved the needle on, you know, driving change within the news industry and helping to kind of remake what we think of when we think of kind of political journalism, that we have moved the needle when it comes to sort of equitable coverage, and that by extension, you know, having an impact with coverage that draws attention to, you know, areas, whether it's in politics or beyond, where women are not necessarily having the opportunities that they should. So yeah, that's sort of a long and roundabout answer, but yeah, we want to be a household name, and we want to be known for strong journalism that's all about helping, you know, level the playing field for women in when it comes to, you know, politics and policy.
And then the last thing we ask all our guests is, what's the last thing you read or watched or listened to that really affected you?
Gosh, there's so much. I feel like particularly when you're in the news business, you're just constantly drinking from the fire hose. But I will say some of the what I've been doing ramping up for this project is trying to take a step back and reading a bit more about leadership and culture. And I may be 10 years late to this, but I've been reading Brené Brown's, I'm still in the midst of reading it, her book Daring Greatly. And what I've loved about it is just this reinforcement of the idea that strong leadership requires a willingness to be vulnerable. I think in the news industry in particular, we really prize, you know, curiosity externally when it comes to asking other people questions and getting to the bottom of mysteries, you know, in the stories that we report. But I think we're a little bit less tolerant of questions when it comes to how we do the work that we do as an industry. And I think this project, you know, the 19th is a case in point of like what can happen when, you dare to be vulnerable. You put a big idea out there, not knowing, you know, how it will be received, but like, you know, knowing that it's needed and being willing to, put yourself out there, not necessarily know all of the answers, but to get the idea rolling and to be willing to invite feedback and willing to be wrong or have someone tell you that they may know more or that they have been there before. And yeah, it's just this whole, I think that's been part of the process of putting together the 19th. It's been a very collaborative process. It's required a lot of humility and vulnerability. And I think, I hope that we continue to kind of incorporate that into our culture as we go. And just the idea that great things can really come when you put yourself out there and when you don't lead with being the smartest person in the room or having all of the answers, but being willing to open yourself up to asking for someone to help you see what blind spots you have and how to overcome those and what you can learn as a result.
So we are really looking forward to the Publisher Podcast Awards, which are now this week.
I have a real dilemma. I can't decide which bow tie to wear. Mm. But apart from that, all going very smoothly.
I know, I can't decide if I'm more terrified or excited right now. but if you can't make it and you didn't get your ticket, you can follow along all the fun on Twitter at PubPodAwards and hashtag PubPodAwards. And you can sign up for updates about entries, categories and all sorts for next year over at publisherpodcastawards.com.
Do it. I had to say that because Peter's not.
And we'll obviously be releasing details of the winners on Thursday on our Media Voices website as well at voices.media.
While you're there, you may as well sign up for our weekly newsletter. It contains a link to the latest episode, links out to a curated list of everything we've been reading that week, and maybe even a link out to some things we've been writing. But we want to take the time now to say thank you so much to Michelle for being a fantastic guest host this week. It's been invaluable getting your expertise.
This was so much fun. You guys are the best.
Fantastic. But until next week, when we're going to be back with, well, Peter, and hopefully we'll be over our hangovers by that point. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.